It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
For many, Easter is a time to mark the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's a time of rebirth and reflection, and for the Christians of Hamdaniya in the Nineveh Plain near Iraq's second city of Mosul, it's particularly relevant. The Christian community here is going through its own rebirth. When ISIL took over the Nineveh Plains in 2014, it tried to destroy the Christian community. Some 55,000 people fled ISIL's violent rule from Hamdaniya alone. When the armed group was defeated late last year, they started to come back. And this is what they found. Destroyed churches and homes.
There is no government support at all. It seems that the government does not care about the people in here. The people here are helpless. When people return to Al-Hamdaniya, they only see their houses burned and destroyed, and their properties looted and stolen. People are spending from their pockets to rebuild their homes, while the government did not show any care so far.
It's a common complaint from Iraqis who feel the government has abandoned them. The Iraqi government is seeking money to rebuild former ISIL areas. It's appealing to the international community for help and says it needs $100 billion. Nowhere near enough cash has been pledged so far. People like Nadia Hanna can't even return because there's nothing to return to. Her house is destroyed and her family scattered across refugee camps and rented accommodations in northern Iraq.
All of my belongings were looted and the house is destroyed. I'm left with nothing at all. I live in a rental in Erbil city. I can't return. My health is deteriorating and I need medical attention. My husband suffers too.
In Baghdad, the Christian community was spared much of the violence that others faced under ISIL. Even here in Baghdad, churches are hidden away behind blast walls and tight security. Now religious leaders and the faithful will be praying that things get better. Iraq's Christians are actually one of the most established religious communities on the entire planet.
Believe it or not, that was a report from Al Jazeera just a few months ago around Easter time, and it kind of gives you a microcosm or a thumbnail sketch of what's going on in Iraq. Iraq, you know, the invasion of Iraq was 2003. For some of you, you're too young to even remember that. For some of us, it feels like just yesterday as we watched the tanks slowly roll into Baghdad and topple the statues of Saddam Hussein. You know, nothing in the Middle East is easy. Nothing is simple. You might think it's complex here, but really, honestly, compared to what's going on in that part of the world, this is really simple here in the United States. And so as our tanks rolled in and people's lives were up, you know, went into upheaval, whether they were Muslim or Christian, the aftermath is still fascinating and troubling. And so we have a conversation that you don't want to miss today. Paul Courier, Dr. Paul Courier, is a research professor with the Institute of World Politics. He's also associate professor at the French equivalent of the West Point. He lectures on U.S. foreign and national security policy, also the role of religion and culture in international affairs. Paul is a Christian academic. He leads with academic, but he happens to be a Christian. I think that would be the way you might say it. He writes for Forbes. He's a contributing editor of Providence, which is a journal of Christianity and American foreign policy. He graduated from Yale, also from London School of Economics. A lot of his expertise is in East Asia, China, Italy, England, and Venezuela. Paul has talked, we've talked quite a bit about Venezuela in recent months and years, but he just spent 10 days on a trip to northern Iraq from the southern Nineveh Plains to the Turkish border. And he comes back to us with fresh eyes and fresh stories that you just must hear about. Dr. Paul Courier, good morning and thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Sandy. Good to be with you again.
You know, Paul, what was it you were trying to do I mean, when you packed your bags and you went there, what was the goal?
The goal was, excuse me, as I've told you, I'm still getting over a little bit of a bug that I got over there as well. So forgive me if I cough a little bit. The goal was I went with a group of four fellow Christians and two Jews, actually a Jewish rabbi, Jewish activist from Chicago, and then four Christians. And the goal was to see what could be done to, first of all, to evaluate the status of the Christian and other ethnic and religious minorities in northern Iraq and in the Nineveh Plain. So we looked at various Christian communities. We looked at the Yazidis, visited with a lot of people. And so we'd evaluate number one and number two, that process of evaluation is so complex because, as you rightfully said, we think that our situation here politically, culturally, et cetera, in the United States is complex. This ain't nothing compared to what's going on over there. So that process just takes a long time to try to drill down and find out what's happening. And then number two, to find out, once we try to get a bit of a picture of what's happening, what can be done to help. And so far, I have to say, a lot of the Christians over there don't believe that the West in general, the United States in particular, despite our words of comfort and support, are really being partners they can depend on. They're not seeing a lot of aid flowing, a lot of assistance. So our goal is to see what we can do to try to get around that and try to help them. We don't want to see Christianity disappear. We want to see it thrive in the cradle of Christianity, which is what Iraq is. So that was the goal of the trip.
Paul, before we get into the details of your trip, I think I always feel like it's necessary to kind of get some tapestry, give a background, because as I don't need to explain to you, most of us in America have very little knowledge of international affairs. We know more about Islam and the Islamic world now because of the wars, but otherwise, that's about all we know. So after Iraq, of course, was already, I guess, more stable in 2003 prior to the invasion, but led by a dictator, but there were Christians. What was Saddam's, do you know what Saddam's relationship with the Christian population was during his time of?
A bit. Excuse me. One of the things that I hear from some sources, at least in the United States, that is very inaccurate, is that Saddam, as horrible as he was in so many ways, was nevertheless a protector of Christians for his own reasons. Utterly untrue. The Christianity was under threat in Iraq as well. It is true that there were a lot more Christians then, and that their numbers have been decimated by 90% since 2003. That is true. And there were about 1.6 million up until 2003. However, those 1.6 million were under a lot of pressure. Saddam would do things like, this is what the Christian leaders just told me last week, he would do things like subsidize Arab Muslims families to move in and take over Christian homes and legally purchase them, or the government would muscle the Christians out and give the homes to Iraqi Muslims, and then hope that demographics would do the rest, that the Muslims that would have numerous children and the Christians, you know, two or three per couple, that gradually over time the Christians would just be finally be marginalized from Iraqi society. So that was already taking place and was a trend under Saddam. Now, that's been exponentially expedited since 2003, and especially since ISIS. So it's been successive waves. The Christians have never had it easy in Iraq.
All right. So do you think that they expected that when America rolled the tanks in, that that would bring them some measure of freedom? I'm asking you questions you may not know, Paul. I need to explain that. But you don't.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And you know what? In all my meetings, I never asked that. In 10 days, I should have. That's a very good question. My sense is that probably, yes, instinctually they thought America, quote-unquote Christian nation, secularist, but, you know, with Christian historical and cultural roots, that and that we were ridding them of someone they deemed to be a demagogue, Saddam Hussein. I'm sure that was what their perception was. It hasn't turned out that way. But I would strongly suspect they would answer that with yes.
Now, let me launch into my rudimentary understanding, because when Iraq easily fell, Baghdad easily fell, much to our surprise. Saddam was found in a hole and he was done away with, and we've had just a struggle since then to sort that area. I think we thought we could fix it. We did establish free elections. All of us remember the purple ink, the people proudly standing in line. That was incredible when they actually got to vote. But then there were other forces at work. There was the brutal fight between Sunni and Shia Muslims, because Iraq was Sunni at the time. And I think didn't the constitution that we established, or that they established, the new one, after that invasion, really instilled Sunni Islamic rule, did it not? And also Sharia?
excuse me, they did give a place for Islamic law. It's not remotely the same as it is in Saudi Arabia, but it did give a place for it, yes.
All right, so then you got, and what, okay, Paul, just because I have no idea about the answer to this. Oh, Iran, of course, is always trying to take over everywhere. So where was Iran in Iraq? What are they doing? What's their role in this?
Well, Iran's role is huge, and I'm glad you asked that, because that is one of the key fundamental factors to try to understand what's happening there. So we have, in Iraq, Iran has huge influence in the Iraqi defense ministry, interior ministry. Under Maliki, the longtime prime minister that started under Bush's tenure and continued into Obama's, he was basically controlled by Tehran to all intents and purposes. The gentleman who's in there now, Abadi, he is not under the thumb of Tehran quite so much, but Tehran still has significant influence over him. One of the ways that Tehran does that is they buy influence. They have maneuvered and purchased and bullied and cajoled until they basically control a fairly large number of seats in the Iraqi parliament. And that's another issue we can talk about later, is there was just Iraqi parliamentary elections, which will determine what sort of government will control Iraq moving forward. And those elections were indeterminate. Somebody tried to burn some ballots when we were over there in one of the ballot storage centers. Now they are, an Iraqi court ordered a recount of all 12 million votes cast. That political process, Iran is very, very good at trying to influence to its benefit. So they've got that as one lever. They also are funding numerous, meaning dozens and dozens and dozens of Shia militias throughout Iraq that were part of what are known as the Popular Mobilization Units, or PMUs. Those PMUs were something that, starting back in 2014, as the Iraqi army melted away in front of Daesh or ISIS's onslaught, Baghdad desperately needed help. There was fear, as you recall, back in 2014 that Baghdad itself would fall and the whole Iraqi state would just be kaput. So they rose up these various popular mobilization units, many of whom were Shia, and almost all of those were funded by Tehran. Those still have a lot of influence throughout Iraq. I saw those all over when I was there. They control checkpoints on major highways between major cities and towns. Therefore, they control communications and transportation. It's a lot of political influence. And Iran has succeeded through that presence and the influence in Baghdad politically in building basically an arc between Iran and the Mediterranean that runs across central and northern Iraq, into Syria, into Lebanon, all the way to the Med. And that's what their goal is. And they've succeeded partly because we have not done a very good job of checking them.
Paul, I know that a lot of the countries of the Middle East have names and identities that were given to them like post-World War II or somewhere, the kind of Western designations of boundaries. And a lot of the people that live...
World War One, after World War One.
They call it Levant. At least that's part of this, where they have a group. So, you hear the music. I've got to take a break here. But when we come back, I'm sorry, I just have to pick your brain on some of this history to lay the foundation, because I'm really interested and fascinated to hear about what your 10 days was like. Paul Coyer's our guest. He's with the Institute of World Politics. And just really right off the plane, just about, from Iraq, from 10 days there, with some incredible stories, which we'll get to in just a second. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
My name is Andaraus, and I'm 25 years old, Christian, and I live in Karakoş. 3 years ago, ISIS came and we all fled. My faith did change, you know, the first days that we were displaced, I feel like there was no God or there was no Jesus because the thing that happened to us. But after that, I realized that Jesus do exist and we have to believe in him. And because of him, we are here today. And today is Palm Sunday, the start of the week of Easter, and we are very excited about it. It's really important to me because it's the day that Jesus went to Jerusalem, and before we fled, we were having Palm Easter every year. It is a big thing, actually. It's, you know, if you went anywhere in the world, you're not gonna find something like this. For the Christian around the world, I'm very happy to share with you this video. You know, because of it, I feel like we are connected with each other. So please do not lose hope. 2 years and a half we were displaced and we never had hope that we are coming back again. But today we're here today because of Jesus, because we had hope in him.
All right, Sandy Rios back with you. That was from Open Doors, and that's the voice of an Iraqi Christian. Dr. Balcoyer just came back from 10 days in Iraq. Iraq is really still in such a mess. Between the factions, the huge factions, the influence of Iran that Paul just described, the battle between the Sunnis and the Shias, the Kurds in the northern section fighting the Turks across the border, it's very complex. And the Yazidis we haven't even mentioned. So please don't turn away. Don't turn off the radio because this is confusing, because we're going to try to make it as user-friendly as we can so that you can understand, and those of you that are Christians will know how to pray and how to help. Dr. Paul Coyer is with the Institute of World Politics. He is an intellectual lecturer, lectures on a lot of things around the world, but he also is a Christian. And so that's the background of what he's going to be saying to us. You know, Paul, you told us earlier that I think 90% of the Christian population has just disappeared or fled or been killed.
Correct.
After the invasion. So what's the current state for Christians in Iraq right now? Where are they and what are they doing? And are they worshiping publicly?
They're able to worship publicly, yes. excuse me. They have many of them are still in refugee camps. I visited with my colleagues a number of refugee camps for Assyrian, Chaldean, and Syriac Christians. And for those that don't know the various makeup of Christians in Iraq, there are generally three different types and some smaller subgroupings as well. There are Assyrians, as in the ancient Assyrian empire that you read about in the scriptures. There are Chaldeans, as you remember Abraham, being from Ur of the Chaldees. And there are Syriacs. They all speak Aramaic, or the language of Christ. They're one of the very few communities of human beings left in the world that still speak the language that Christ spoke, which is amazing. They do worship publicly. There are churches. I visited many churches, numerous monasteries, some of whom are, one of whom I visited last week, not far from Mosul, is 1,700 years old. That's been there since 300 years after Christ and 300 years before Muhammad and the beginning of Islam. So it speaks to the deep roots of Christianity in the region, but they do worship publicly. They're living in a number of different settings. They're living, as I mentioned, in refugee camps that are funded in some cases by the United Nations, in some cases by various governments. I visited one that was funded by the government of Japan, others by the government of France, by the United States, et cetera. Some have returned to their homes in Mosul, which had quite a large Christian population. It had quite a large population period before ISIS, quite some time ago, it had a population of nearly 2 million. Now they claim a population of about 600,000. I didn't get into Mosul, but I got close, and everyone told me there's almost nobody living there. So many Christians have just not returned to their homes because they just don't feel secure. And that's one of the biggest problems right now, is that they need that sense of security. And when they depend on, or are forced to depend on, an Iraqi army that they don't really trust, or worse yet, Shia militias, which are funded by Tehran, whom they don't trust, they really don't feel secure enough to return to those homes and to put their future in the hands of somebody else. They want it to be in their own hands. So one of the ways that one of the things that makes them feel more secure is if they have their own security force. So I spent a lot of time with one particular security force of Christians while I was there, a Christian militia, known as the Nineveh Plains Protection Units, or the NPU. These are Assyrian Christians. There's only 500 of them, so minuscule. But that's all the Iraqi government will fund. They do have some weapons, almost no ammunition. They have very little. But these brave men are doing whatever they can to try to police the areas that have Christians still in them, in the Nineveh Plain, and to try to instill some sort of sense of confidence in their fellow Christians that at least they have some minimal force now that can defend themselves with.
Paul, you know, I was interviewing probably another mutual friend of ours. Probably it's been a year now. I'm just blanking on his name. But he was telling me that in Syria, at least, Christians were coming back to their homes to find that Muslims had taken their homes.
Oh, yes. Iraq, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so they can't.
And that's one of the issues is how do you reconcile and bring, you know, Christianity is what's it about? We're about the ministry of reconciliation, right? And now among ourselves as fellow Christians, but among between Christ and the world, and also between us and other parts of the world. And it's very difficult to bring a nation together that's that divided, especially when you have a long history and a recent painful history of Muslim neighbors that have come to, this happened to one of my friends, a brief story that goes along with what you just said. His family back in Iraq, when ISIS came in 2014, their Muslim neighbors they lived next to for 30 years, heard that ISIS was coming and had announced that all Christian homes would now belong to Muslims. And Christians had 48 hours to leave or be killed or just be kicked out of their homes and enslaved. And the Muslim neighbor came next door. They'd always got along with very well and said, this is what the announcement is. We are going to take your home, and I have the legal right to kill you if you are still here in 48 hours. And this family was shocked and didn't know whether it was a joke or how to take it. They'd never experienced anything like this before. And the next day, 24 hours later, same guy came back, gave him the same message, and they finally realized, oh my gosh, this is serious. And they left. And on the way out of town, they dropped the keys off to their house, and they said, we're so sorry you've chosen to do this. We thought we were neighbors and close friends. Nevertheless, this is our house with our blessing and Christian love. So they behaved as Christians should behave, but how do you rebuild trust in a society where that sort of thing is ubiquitous, where that happens again and again and again? How do you trust your Muslim neighbors again after that sort of thing happens thousands and thousands of times over, over a brief period?
We should explain, Paul, I've discussed this many times, but it's been a while, that the Muslim practice of making dhimmis out of non-Muslims
right.
is part of what we're talking about here. This is normal
right.
in their culture, and they may not practice it, but they do all over the world practice it eventually when they, it's part of Muslim teaching. You outpopulate
yeah.
and then you, you make people around you subservient who are not Muslim, practicing Muslims.
Yeah. You talk to many Muslims today that are Westernized, that are more secularized, more liberal, if you will, Muslims. And they look in horror when they hear about that, man, because that idea is alien to them. However, when you look at Islamic history, yes, you're absolutely right. That is a big part of Muslim history and a practice that they've practiced ever since the 7th century. And ISIS brought it back with a vengeance, yeah.
I'm curious about something. You know, when we use the designation Christian, you know better than I, as well as I, that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. It can be just a general
right.
description Christian as opposed to Muslim, or it can be a particular sect. When you described it, when you laid out Assyrians and Chaldeans.
Yeah, in the Iraqi context, you have mainly three different types of Iraqi Christians. You have the Assyrians, who are the descendants of the Assyrian Empire. You have the Chaldeans, and you have the Syriacs. All those are actually basically the same ethnic community. And they actually are the original inhabitants of Iraq. So you said you wanted to build a brief historical summary so people with no background can understand. That's something that's key to understand, that these Christians in Iraq are ethnically of a different type of people than the Kurds or the Arabs. or the Turkmen or any of the other surrounding neighbors, and they're the oldest surviving people group in Iraq. So they really are the original inhabitants, the natives of that region. And this is one reason why Iraq is part of the cradle of Christianity, because these people groups all converted to Christianity with about a generation of Christ. So they've been Christians since the beginning. So you have these major three groups, the Chaldeans, Assyrians, and Syriacs. Then you have some Armenians. You have a very few Christians that are Kurds and that are Arabs and that are Turkmen who are also Christian, a very small minority, but they're there as well. And then on the Muslim side, of course, as you mentioned, you've got the Shia and Sunni. You also have the the Kurds, which are Muslim, but a more liberal sort of Muslim. Part of the problem, however, is the Kurds and the Assyrian Christians have competing national identities because they're different ethnic groups. It's not just a faith conflict, it's a national identity conflict. So you have Syrians that have land claims that go back, the Assyrians have been there for 5,000+ years, the Kurds for 3,000 or 4,000 years, so relatively newer, but still there a long time. And then you've got all these competing land claims. The Assyrians have a sense that the Kurds, despite being obviously better than ISIS and not pursuing genocide, are pursuing policies in the Kurdistan Regional Government, or the KRG, which has been in existence since the first Gulf War, 1991, and for all intents and purposes controlled much of northern Iraq that is Iraqi Kurdistan. The Kurdistan Regional Government has pursued policies, the Assyrians have told me repeatedly over there, that are gradually pushing the Assyrians out of the few communities that they still are in. So they, for instance, will have Kurds that the Kurdish government will push Kurdish families to move to certain historically Assyrian towns, for instance, and gradually buy Assyrian homes and push them out. There's the demographic issue as well. Can't tell you how many young Assyrians I talked to, very well-educated Assyrian Christians, also Chaldean and other Christians, that had medical degrees, that were veterinary medicine practitioners, that were graduates of conservatories, talked to one young man who was a keyboardist, quite a talented guy, engineers, doctors, lawyers, etc., could not get work because it's on your ID card that you're an Assyrian Christian, therefore you don't get work. So the KRG, the Kurdistan Regional Government, they have been good allies of the U.S. since 1991 in many ways. They have not gotten a fair shake from us. They are a minority that themselves have been persecuted. But because of these competing national identity and land claims and historical claims to that land, there's this competition with Assyrian Christians that makes, in many cases, the Kurds the persecutors of the minority Christians as well. It's a really, like I said, a complex situation.
Paul, I just, if it's possible to make this distinction, I started to say, you know, these Christian labels all mean sort of different things with different nuances. But I'm curious to know if the part of this or the subgroup of this, if there is such a thing of people who aren't just Christian by culture, not for the 2,000 years that they've been there, 16, whatever many years, but really are serious followers of Jesus.
Oh, no, you mean people who are actually practicing daily Christians that try to follow Christ and live out the golden rule and take their faith seriously? Absolutely. I didn't meet one person over there who was what we would call a cultural Christian in the West. You know, the world considers the West quote-unquote Christian. You and I know that's, that's a matter of definition. Christian, you're not, just like you're not a car because you stand in the garage, you're not a Christian because you live in the West or you claim to be. And it's the same thing there. But every single one of the people who self-identified as Christian in Iraq that I met were people who were very serious about their faith. Many of them had literally faced death because of their faith and had not renounced it. So, no, these are not people who are just Christian by cultural identity or national identity or historical identity. These are actual, honest-to-goodness Christians.
So we touched on, so Iraq has a government. You said there were just now elections, recently?
Right.
So what can you say about, is that body intact and able to govern the country? Or is it just kind of in some ways a sham exercise?
A sham is a let's just go with, is there a government now that, that there's a government, we're in waiting mode, basically. The outcome of the election is in doubt because of the fact that there were a lot of charges of fraud. And as I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, there was, when we were over there about a week ago, I remember seeing on the news and hearing from my Iraqi friends that somebody had tried to burn a large number of ballot boxes. Evidently, seems transparently an effort to hide evidence of ballot tampering, ballot stuffing, because there was already talk then that there was going to need to be a recount because of all the allegations of fraud. So someone tried to cover their tracks. From what I understand, the fire didn't do much damage, but my larger point is that is just what happens over there.
Paul, hang on. Hold that thought, because we have to take a break. Yeah, we'll pick up with that. I also, I want to talk to you about the effect that it's having on the Christians there now. You know, if they're holding fast, if they're discouraged, and certainly we want to talk about if there's anything that we could do to help. Paul Collier is my guest with the Institute of World Politics. This is Sandy Rios, back in a second on AFA Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
We're right here on the border between Turkey and Iraq. And what makes this operation against the PKK terror group so different is that while the PKK has still been using this Kandil mountain range as a nerve center and as a base of operations to launch cross-border attacks into Turkey since the peace process collapsed in 2015. This time around, military officials are saying that this operation is going to be much larger in scale and will likely establish a string of military bases in Kandil to prevent the PKK from re-establishing their presence in this area. Of course, the PKK's leadership also uses the Kandil mountain range as not only as a base of operations, but also as to establish training centers for their fighters and their cadres to launch cross-border attacks into Turkey and into Syria. Many of the PKK's Syrian affiliate fighters, the YPG, also train and receive their instructions from the PKK's leadership here in the Kandil. So this time around, we're hearing from military sources that this operation is going to be different, is going to be larger in scale, and will use not only airstrikes, but also ground operations in order to prevent once and for all the PKK from using the Kandil mountain range as a base of operations to launch cross-border attacks into Turkey and into Syria.
All right, and you thought you were confused before? That was a broadcast from Turkish television. And, of course, their perspective is that the Kurds in the north are their deadly enemies. That's the PKK. Those are the Turkish fighters. That's the north of Iraq. And, of course, the Turks and the Kurds are fast at war. But that's still the country of Iraq. Paul Collier is my guest, and he's just come back from 10 days there. And we're trying to lay this out as clearly as we can. And it's kind of a little bit hard to do. Nevertheless, I think you'll have learned quite a bit when we finish this conversation. Paul, before we move on to that, just if you would, finish your thought about what's happening in the Iraqi parliament, because I ask you if they had real power or if it was just a sort of a, I don't know what to call it, just a structure that was really not in control but had names and alleged authority.
Yeah, no, the Iraqi parliament does have governing authority, not just constitutionally, but it has real-life impact, which is why people are fighting for the seats so strongly and why there was apparently attempt at fraud and why they have to do a recount. It really matters what happens here. So, as I mentioned just briefly, the election that had taken place on May the 12th is disputed. They are recounting all 12 million ballots cast right now. Nobody knows exactly what's going to happen. Everyone was shocked that the person who ended up on top in terms of the vote count was Muqtada al-Sadr. Now, anyone who's been following Iraq for the last 15 years or so may recall that he had Shia militiamen that he had sponsored against the Americans in 2003 and onward. He has at various times tacked toward Iran. At other times, he has tacked away from it, which is where he is right now. Now he's sounding like more of an Iraqi nationalist that wants Iraqi independence and does not want so much Iranian influence. He turned out the parties he controls, he's not a politician, but the parties that he leads won the most votes. Underneath that, the Fatah Alliance, there's a gentleman named Hadi al-Amiri who came in with a very close second. And then the existing Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi came in at number three, basically, in terms of vote count. Abadi is trying to hold on to his position as Prime Minister, probably will not. But again, everything depends on what happens with the vote recount. But how it relates to the Iraqi Christians in particular is important, is they have a quota under the American, the new constitution that the Americans helped guide the Iraqis in writing. After 2003, the Iraqi Christians were given a quota of 5 seats. The problem is, up until now, those 5 seats, anybody could vote for them. So any Muslim, any Kurd, anybody else could vote for who was going to represent Iraq's Christians, which doesn't quite seem fair. So a bill passed Iraq's parliament when we were there last week that finally said that only Iraqi Christians could vote for who were going to represent Iraqi Christians in the parliament. So God willing, moving forward, that will be much better for them.
You said, and we've already mentioned, that there's so many factions here. We mentioned Iran and their role, which is huge.
Yep.
We mentioned, that obviously encompasses the fight between Sunni and Shia Muslims, and you just mentioned Muqtadir. And I mentioned the Kurds in the north and the Turks. What other, besides that, what other factions are at play here? What other outside forces and inside forces?
Well, you've got a lot of outside forces, but also just internally. You mentioned in the intro to our segment here, the gentleman was talking about the fighting between the PKK, which is known as the Kurdish Workers Party, so named because it was started in the middle of the Cold War in 1978. It's not Marxist-Leninist now, but was originally. And that's in the north along the, it's in southeastern Turkey and along the border of northern Iraq. We were up there. We heard the airstrikes. We heard Turkish jets overhead. We saw Turkish military installations. The fighting is very real up there. That Kurdish group does not get along at all with the Kurdish group in Erbil, with the KRG, the Kurdistan Regional Government. So the Kurdistan Regional Government that controls much of northern Iraq is actually in a tacit alliance with Turkey against their fellow Kurds, the PKK. Mm-hmm. So if that's not confusing enough, that just adds to a bit of complexity to how Christians in that region, and there's a lot of historical Christian communities in southeastern Turkey and northern Iraq, are all being squeezed by this fighting as well. You mentioned Sunni and Shia, so I just wanted to mention quickly, the Gulf states are pouring a lot of money into Iraq to counter Tehran's money. So remember I said that Iran is putting a lot of money into Shia militiamen and into influence in Baghdad? Well, the Gulf states are doing the same thing. So they have Sunni militias that they're sponsoring, and they're sponsoring schools and madrasas just like they do throughout the rest of the Middle East that are not just countering Iran, but they're also advancing a rather virulent form of Wahhabism, which is definitely not to the benefit of Christians over there, and that's making them extremely nervous.
Paul, I just can't imagine how a people like you describe the Christians, who've been reduced by 90%, who cannot even return to their homes or living in camps, I don't know how in the world that they can survive against almost every area being against them, inside and outside. So we didn't even mention that Erdogan is an Islamist of the first degree, wants to reestablish the Ottoman Empire and bring in the end times according to Muslim prophecy. He's a real danger to the Muslim world, depending, I guess, on your perspective. And so he's attacking. Hates Christians. How are Christians surviving spiritually and emotionally? What is their state of mind right now?
Excuse me. I don't know how many times I heard people, Christians there, tell me if we could get out, we would. We just don't have any avenues and no one will give us a visa. Now, unfortunately, under the Trump administration, when President Trump announced in 2016, that you may recall when he was campaigning, he announced that he would not do what the Obama administration had done, which is to keep Middle Eastern Christians from coming. Unfortunately, nothing has really happened to quicken that flow. Nevertheless, in my case, speaking for myself, I don't want to see the rest of the Christians left taken out and made into Westerners. I would rather see them stay. The problem is, again, as I mentioned at the beginning of our talk, they need security and they need to control their own security, and they need some sort of economic means of supporting themselves. They have no jobs. They have no means of support. And it's really hard to live when you have no income and no security both, and you're surrounded by nothing but hostile people. So they try to be hopeful, but it's difficult.
So is there anything besides prayer, which is can be powerful, can also just be an excuse for not really doing something physical?
Yeah.
What can we do, Paul? I mean, what can we do?
Very good question. There are numerous groups on the ground working there that I had a lot of meetings with. There's the Assyrian Aid Society, which is one organization. donations can be given to them. They are a 501c3 here in the United States, as well as being on the ground in Iraq. There are many other organizations that can be given to. The lady that led our group is an Iranian Assyrian Christian who's based in Chicago now. She has an organization called the Iraqi Christian Relief Council. That is something that is also 501c3 that we can give to. There are numerous projects that we came across when we were there for 10 days, including just one example. The Assyrian Christian Women's Union in northern Iraq has a number of preschools and daycare centers. They have simple needs that wouldn't cost much. Like, one of the schools only needed a mere $300 for toys for the kids, things like that. Bedding, textbooks, you know, videos, things like that, simple things. And money just to pay the teachers, because many times they don't have money to pay the teachers. They can be supported, and this can make a huge difference. And these preschools actually serve more than just Christians. Some Muslims, because the excellent nature of the schools, are putting their 4 and 5 year olds in these schools as well, which is very good for them. When I was there, I saw, for instance, the Syrian Aid Society giving away air conditioners that have been donated. And when you have constant 100 to 120 degree heat in your home, or even in your trailer in your displaced persons park, your refugee park, if you live there, that can make a huge difference to the quality of life. And those have been donated by both Iraqi Christians living in the United States, expats, and also Westerners like you and I. So there are concrete things that you could do. And I can give you this information afterward. We can perhaps, if you're interested, put it up on your website for listeners that really want to know where to give safely to transparent organizations that can help these Christians on the ground. There are numerous ways we could do that. And I met with a lot of these people and have a lot of confidence that these are great people doing good work. They run their organizations transparently, and they have a foothold legally here in the United States as well as Iraq. It would help children. It would help women and women's groups. You can give to any number of groups.
Absolutely, Paul. We will, as soon as we get that from you, we will post that on our Facebook page and make sure people are equipped to do that. You know, I know firsthand that there are still some Western missionaries there. We can't say where exactly, and we shouldn't. But did you see any? You probably didn't, because they kind of have to keep their heads down. And
I didn't. No, I didn't see any Western missionaries. We met with mostly church leaders. We met with Chaldean Catholic bishops. We met with the Assyrian Church of the East Patriarch, who was virtually their pope. We met with the head of the Yazidi community, the spiritual head there. We met with a lot of native religious leaders, but didn't see any Western missionaries there.
Well, how would you describe the Yazidis? Because they're kind of a mystery, hard to describe. They have their own brand of a mixture of Islam, right? What is it?
Yes. It is hard to describe, and I really can't give you a good theological framework in just 60 seconds. It's basically best described as a very syncretistic mix of Christianity and Islam and other native religions. It's a little strange from our perspective. We met with the head of the Yazidi community. As I mentioned, his name is Baba Sheikh, or like Papa Sheikh, kindly old man. His brother is his chief advisor. And they're in dire straits as well. So likewise, there are Yazidi organizations that are 501c3 here in the U.S. that you can give to help them. We visited a Yazidi camp. They're in just as much need as the Christians are, although there are more of them. Nobody knows exactly how many, but there's somewhere between 600,000 and 800,000 Yazidis left in Iraq, as opposed to maybe 150,000 Christians.
How would you describe, you've already touched on it, but how would you describe the official diplomatic or aid relationship or military relationship between the U.S. and Iraq right now?
The U.S. and Iraq in general, I would not be well placed to really talk about that. I do know that we provided some training for the various Christian and other militias that are part of the popular mobilization units I described at the beginning of our talk, the PMUs, which were kind of irregular forces that were not formally part of the Iraqi military at first, but now they technically are legally. Christian militias, fixed Christian militias, are part of a large number, and experts can't even agree to how many different militias there are, between 60 and 100. But the U.S. has had some training of these groups, so that's been very positive. But there's no real ongoing relationship.
Okay, well, there's no question that all of us, if you are a Christian listening to this conversation, I'm trusting that already you've been offering prayers as Paul's talked, that God would, do we need to talk God into helping his people? Not too much, but we can agree with him in prayer that we would, if we could do anything about it, we would want to know that God reveal that to us, that we be actively involved in helping them, and also that we just ask God to strengthen them in the midst of their persecution. And that ultimately is the goal for all of us, whatever situation we find ourselves in. Paul Coyer with the Institute of World Politics. Paul, thank you so much for sharing this fresh from your journey. And God bless you and get you well, by the way, from whatever it is you caught over there. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.